Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. Beth Emmanuel teaches Messianic Judaism for all nations, and we would like to be your long-distance congregation. If you listen regularly at BethEmmanuel.org, consider supporting us with regular financial gifts and become a virtual member. Click on the support button at BethEmmanuel.org.
Here's how it begins. The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants the things that must soon take place. He made it known by sending his angel to his servant John, who bore witness to the word of God and to the testimony of Jesus Christ, even to all that he saw. All right, so these first two verses introduce the book, tell us what it is, tell us what we're looking at. It is a revelation. It is the revealing of concealed things. That's what revelation means. The revealing of concealed things that God granted to his son, Yeshua, Jesus Christ, Yeshua the Messiah, so that he, in turn, could deliver it over to the charge of his angel, who, in turn, could deliver it over to John, who could deliver it to the servants of Messiah, so that they could obtain a preview of things that must take place. So this is the order of the transmission of the revelation. God reveals it to the Messiah to his angel to John, John to Messiah's servants. And then it says in the third verse, "Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy. And blessed are those who hear and who keep what is written, for the time is near." And this is a beatitude, just like the "blessed are the poor in spirit" type of beatitudes. In Hebrew, we say the ashrei. It's an ashrei statement. Ashrei means happy or glad, or the gladness of, or which we translate as typically as "blessed are." But it implies that the revelation was intended for public reading. Public reading in the assembly of Messiah. That is, blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy. And it implies, the Beatitude implies, that the book of Revelation is also intended for those who will listen in the assembly, of course. Those who hear, blessed are they. And finally, blessed are those who keep what is written therein. So that's the essential meaning of the first three verses of Revelation. What is it? What is this big revelation that God revealed to his Messiah? The Messiah to his angel, his angel to John, and John to us? The revelation is the visions and everything that follows in the rest of the book. But we could also translate revelation as apocalypse. The apocalypse of Jesus Christ, which God gave to him to show his servants. So the word in Greek is apokalypsis. It means literally unveiling. So we might say the apokalypsis of Yeshua the Messiah, which God gave to him to show his bondservants. What's the difference? When you think of an apocalypse, what do you usually think of? A nuclear catastrophe or something, right? Instead, this is referring to just the revelation of something that's concealed. Enoch is the classic example of somebody who receives a revelation like this. You know the story of Enoch? Enoch walked with God, right? And he was not, for God took him. As you know, that's in our Torah portion this week, right? That's in Bereishit. Enoch was more or less beamed up, raptured alive, taken into paradise, in the flesh, not at all unlike Elijah, who also ascended. And in Jewish tradition, Enoch and Elijah they share the unique distinction of being two men who have never tasted death. So the writer of the book of Hebrews explains, by faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death. And he was not found because God had taken him. Well, what was he taken up for? One of the things he was taken up for was an apocalypse, an unveiling, to see things and reveal things that were previously concealed. So in the days of the apostles, there was a great body of Jewish tradition that had grown up around the character of Enoch, and you might even say that, in a sense, Enoch is the father of Jewish mysticism. Now, naturally, people wanted to know more about the Enoch story. We all do. So sometime in the centuries before the birth of the Master, someone wrote or revealed a collection of literature that has come to us to be known as the Book of First Enoch. But in the days of the apostles, the mystics were reading and studying this mysterious Book of Enoch. The Book of Enoch is the classic apocalypse, and Revelation follows in its footsteps. It actually follows in the genre that was carved out by the Book of Enoch. So apocalypse is a type of literature. What type of literature is it? It's the type of literature where there's a guy who gets to ascend to heaven, and an angel gives him a tour of the place, and he gets to see all sorts of otherwise unseen things. Unseen things that lie behind seen things. And he usually gets to see the heavens, you know, the seven heavens, the throne, the angels. He gets to hear heavenly worship services. He gets to tour heavenly chambers where God keeps various stuff that he keeps in heavenly chambers. He gets to see spiritual places, palaces, and there's war. He sees war between the forces of good and evil, and this war plays out in the field of human events in this present world. But he sees what's behind the war. And all of that history culminates in a final end time battle between good and evil, more often than not. And that's what an apocalypse is. It's when all that stuff happens. You got an apocalypse. So the Book of Enoch is the first big apocalypse. And according to the Book of Enoch, Enoch was caught up to the heavens. Are you with me on this? Everyone's okay with that? Enoch was caught up to the heavens in the body, not, you know, he was physically caught up in the body, into the heavens where he saw things otherwise unseen. So an apocalypse involves some type of ascension, or the word translation, we might say translation, or a vision or dream related in the first person. So a common element of an apocalypse is an ascension, a translation, or a vision, or a dream. That's like the first thing on the list. And then once you get there, you have angelic tour guides. Oftentimes, you know, the seer in the apocalypse, he beholds a portion of this, you know, he gets to see some of the heavens, and he gets this angelic tour guide to take him around on a tour of heaven. So this is the experience. This is the experience of the apocalypse. In the Book of Enoch, for example, the angels give him a tour, and he sees the spiritual forces at work, and he sees the spirits of the dead in Gehenna and in paradise. And he sees the Son of Man seated on the throne of glory, and he sees the Ancient of Days, and he hears him speak, and he sees the final battles, and he sees the end of all things, and he sees the Son of Man in judgment. That's in the Book of Enoch. And then, you know, you might get, as you're getting this tour, what are you going to see in heaven? But angels around the throne, right? Worshiping the Lord. You know, so oftentimes the seer gets to see a heavenly worship service, visions of the heavenly throne, and he hears the liturgical chants, and it's liturgy. They're using liturgy. And there's these angelic choirs, and they're worshiping the Lord, and we get to actually hear how they're worshiping God in these apocalypses. Oftentimes, the seer in the apocalypse, he doesn't know if he's ascended literally or if he's just having a vision. I mean, maybe he's just having a vision. With Enoch, we saw Enoch was more or less taken up. But regarding Paul, it says, I know a man in Messiah who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that this man was caught up into paradise. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And he heard things which cannot be told, which a man may not utter. This is a classic experience of a first century apocalypse. Now, unfortunately,
Paul received the gag order on whatever he saw. Otherwise, we'd have maybe a book of the apocalypse of Paul. And there probably is an apocryphal version of such a thing. But this is a typical unveiling type of experience. So in Jewish literature, we find we get a lot of these. I mean, with titles like, other than Enoch, titles like the Apocalypse of Abraham, the Apocalypse of Adam, the Apocalypse of Elijah, the Apocalypse of Baruch, the Apocalypse of Ezra, the Apocalypse of Noah. And all of these, in one way or another, in some aspect or another, all of these uniquely parallel the Apocalypse of John, the Apocalypse of the Revelation. And to understand the Revelation, it's necessary to have the keys that you obtain from these apocalypses. I mean, it's Revelation is simultaneously the most studied and least understood book of the Bible. Modern readers find the symbolism and densely packed allusions of apocalyptic literature to be unintelligible. And so the book is like locked up in this symbolism, and we no longer have the keys to unlock the symbolism. But the first century believer didn't find the symbolism nearly as obscure as we do today, because the first century believer that John was writing for, you know, was familiar with this form of literature. And you know, it happens to people. This apparently it happened to Paul. You know, it happens to people that they have this experience, you know, occasionally, once in a while, you might experience a lifting of the veil when the unseen becomes seen for a moment, and things that are otherwise only hoped for become substantial for a moment. It doesn't happen to everyone. I don't know why. And it doesn't happen the same way when it does. And not everyone is a mystic. But once in a while, you might have an experience with the living God. And it might be a small thing, a brief revelation, a personal experience, a dream, a vision, a small moment when you actually see, when you actually hear, a quick subjective encounter with the supernatural, or it might be an apocalypse, like what Paul was describing there. Whether in the body or out of the body, I don't know. Like what the prophets experienced, or Daniel's visions in the book of Daniel. It's an unveiling. And while you're there, you might be getting a tour of heaven from these angelic tour guides. Just some of the other, some other common things we find in apocalypses. An apocalypse wants to show mortals that although things on earth seem terribly unjust, with the righteous suffering and the wicked prospering and so forth, that a day is coming when God will reveal His wrath against the wicked, and the righteous will be rewarded. In an apocalypse, we see that in the future, God will intervene in human affairs and serve justice, rewarding the righteous and punishing the wicked. The apocalypse wants to show that our faith is not in vain, and that although things seem unjust now and are unjust, and injustices are perpetrated on a regular basis, it's not going to be like that forever. One of these days, God is going to roll up His sleeves, He's going to peel back the veil, and He's going to get involved in human events in a revealed way rather than a concealed way. And this is the central theme of every apocalypse. It's what every apocalypse is building up toward. An apocalypse reveals that God is sovereign, and He will not be patient forever. Ultimately, He will set the world aright. Powerful evil forces oppose Him, but in the final culmination of things, He defeats His enemy. And it tells this story, an apocalypse tells this story of God's intervention and so forth, typically in highly symbolic language. For example, mythical beasts represent forces of evil and world empires. Flocks of sheep represent the people of God. A sword represents judgment and so forth. And we find that these These symbols are somewhat fairly consistent from apocalypse to apocalypse. This all started in the book of Daniel, this kind of language. And arguably, you could say Daniel is the very first book of this genre, of this apocalyptic genre. But more than just literary devices, the symbolism of an apocalypse is meant to be interpreted and puzzled over. It's supposed to be a little cryptic. It's intentionally ambiguous to make us go, wonder what that means. It's on purpose. Finally, a typical apocalypse offers its readers hope and encouragement. A word of hope, a word of encouragement for the faithful. The seer in the apocalypse encourages the faithful to remain faithful because despite the calamity of current circumstances, the person sees through the unveiling that one day the righteous will be rewarded and the wicked will be punished, and that everything that is amiss is going to be set right. And that's what it is. That's what an apocalypse is. So now you know. Here's what it's not. An apocalypse is not a crystal ball to predict the future. An apocalypse is not a description of current events. An apocalypse is not a sequence or chart of end time events. An apocalypse is not even a literal narrative. And finally, an apocalypse, even though it's not a literal narrative, neither is it an allegory. It's not an allegory in the sense of something that can be spiritualized away. So when an apocalypse depicts future events, such as the coming kingdom of Messiah on earth, it may do so, in fact, it pretty much always does so, in an allegorical style with symbolic language. But it's allegorically depicting literal events which will take place in the future. That's the assumption of the apocalypse. Although the book of Revelation is highly symbolic, no question about that, it's not allegorical as the church supposed it was. When Christianity separated from Judaism, it also separated from a literal reading of a lot of the prophets. A lot of the prophetic passages about the restoration of Israel in the Messianic era that we read in prophets like Isaiah and Ezekiel and Jeremiah, a lot of these prophecies of the restoration of the Jewish people in a literal physical kingdom of Israel, these were taken and spiritualized and allegorized to say, no, this is referring to the rise of the church, this is referring to the coming of the church. So the book of Revelation was particularly troubling to the Christian church because it confirmed Jewish eschatology, Jewish end time stuff, about a literal future kingdom of heaven on earth under King Messiah. And so church leaders who rejected this idea of a restored Israel occupying a literal messianic kingdom, they declared this to be carnal nonsense. They declared, the early church fathers declared the book of Revelation to be heretical and carnal nonsense. Carnal nonsense meaning fleshly, meaning physical, because it spoke of a physical, literal kingdom that they understood to be only spiritual, only allegorical. So Revelation, because of that, was one of the very last books to receive canonization. And many early church theologians never accepted it. It was still being debated in the 4th century, 400 years after it had been written. It still had not been received by the entire church. In the end, of course, as we know, the church did retain the book of Revelation, but it opted, by and large, for an allegorical interpretation of the book that pushed aside the notion of a literal messianic kingdom on earth. It's only in the last couple hundred years that a literal reading of the messianic kingdom has come back into Christian interpretation, and this through primarily through dispensationalism or through Sabbatarianism. Why is Revelation so hard
to understand? Well, the first, as we've already learned, it's the apocalypse genre itself is a stumbling block. You know, the very genre of the book makes it difficult to understand. Because we don't understand apocalypse, we don't read other apocalypses, this one sticks out like a sore thumb, and it's like, it's you know, what is this? You get into Revelation, and it's like a zoo in there. Another reason modern readers find Revelation difficult is because we fail to realize that the book is not addressed to us. It's not addressed to a general readership living in any age or living in the end times, but rather it's written to first century believers. It was specifically addressed to believers under the Apostle John's apostolate in Asia Minor, namely the seven assemblies. So whatever other interpretations and meanings that we might come up with or derive from the book of Revelation, we have to remember that the message of the book was originally intended for Jewish and Gentile believers living in Asia Minor during the last decades of the first century during the Domitian persecution. So any interpretation of Revelation which strays too far from that would not have been readily apparent and comprehensible to those believers in John's congregations, should be treated with extreme suspicion. That's a rule that we're going to observe. Would this have made sense in the first century? Okay, why is it hard to understand? This is a really big one. Maybe not so much here, but I think outside of these walls, this is a big problem. It's a Jewish book. I mean, it's really Jewish. I know the whole New Testament's Jewish, but Revelation is really, really Jewish. Maybe too Jewish. Modern readers find the book of Revelation especially difficult because we're unfamiliar with the Jewish background to its symbolism. Imagery drawn from the biblical prophets, allusions to prophecies clutter the text. You can't make it through a verse without tripping over two prophecies from the Old Testament. Imagery derived from Jewish tradition is everywhere. Jewish liturgical ceremonies, Jewish eschatology saturates the book. Themes from the high holidays of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur appear in the form of shofar blasts, a door standing open in heaven, white garments of the righteous, the call to repent before the final judgment, the books of judgment opening, the book of life, the final judgment, the world to come. Multitudes around the throne with palm branches in their hands recreate the temple worship of the festival of Sukkot. So Revelation transposes several ceremonial and liturgical functions of the temple that were known in the first century into the heavenly temple. But if we don't know the temple on earth, which is a reflection of the heavenly, you know, we don't know what's going on. So without a Jewish background and familiarity with the temple and the synagogue and the Jewish calendar and Jewish liturgy, all of this imagery becomes hopelessly cryptic. But that's why we have an advantage here. In Messianic Judaism, we have an advantage in this department. All right, so why is it hard to understand? I've given you three reasons here, but there's a fourth. Fourth reason that readers find Revelation very difficult to understand. It's not a manual to the end times. We find it difficult to understand because we bring the wrong set of assumptions. We look to it to find information about the end of days and how things are gonna unspool in the last days. But the book of Revelation doesn't present a sequential description of end times events. Instead, it assumes that its readers are already familiar with the general flow of Jewish end times expectations and messianic eschatology. And Revelation simply takes from that existing large pool of Jewish thought of how the end times will come about, the apostolic thought, and adapts the broad strokes of the existing system of Jewish eschatology to present an apocalyptic vision from behind the veil. All right. So, now, here's what we're going to do. Before we get into actually learning anything, I'm going to give you a... because all that's just by way of introduction. I'm going to give you a quick rundown, because So this is kind of like spoilers. If you've not read it before, the book of Revelation begins with a vision of the risen master, Yeshua, commissioning John as a prophet to record the visions that he has seen and things which are and things which will take place after these things. This statement covers a pretty broad range of history. History that's addressed, you know, throughout the book. The book of Revelation then presents, you know, taking this cue, things that you have seen, things which are, and things which will take place after these things. The book of Revelation presents what I would say is a spinning kaleidoscope of visions of the past, visions of the present, visions of the future. And this explains why much of the content of the book seems to pertain at times to the era of Nero and the Jewish War. And much of it seems to pertain to the era of Domitian when it was being written, and much of it seems to pertain to the end of days, which is the future that is in sight here. This past, present, future focus of Revelation, I believe, corresponds to the angelic acclamation of the thrice holy God who was and who is to come. So you have holy, who was the past, holy, who is the present, and holy, who is to come, the future. And our master intended the vision of the revelation then primarily for those in the present, which was 95 CE, you know, around then, 95 AD. Primarily for those believers in Asia Minor who were suffering under a new wave of Roman persecution. And he gives John messages for the seven assemblies under his apostolate in Asia Minor: Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. The messages rebuke the assemblies for their failings and praise them for their successes and encourage them to stay faithful in the face of persecution. Then the real apocalypse starts. A voice invites John to ascend to the heavenly places where he beholds a vision of the throne and the Lamb surrounded by angelic worship. A scroll with seven seals is unrolled, and with the breaking of each seal, a vision of judgment on earth unfolds. Angels sound seven trumpets. Each trumpet brings a vision of judgment. Seven angels pour out seven bowls of plague on the earth. Further judgments fall on the woman who rides the beast, a woman drunk with the blood of martyred believers. And John records a vision of Israel depicted as a pregnant heavenly woman bringing forth a son opposed by Satan and a great dragon. And a great deal of the ensuing imagery revolves around the spiritual identity of the Roman Empire and its Caesars. John sees a bestiary of monsters depicting the power of Rome and different emperors, all empowered by one master, the devil. And he sees the Lamb on Mount Zion with his followers, and a great contest between these two forces ensues. The beast, which is Caesar, demands the worship and allegiance of all the people on earth. Those holding fast to the Torah of God and the testimony of Yeshua refuse to worship the beast, and they pay the price in martyrdom. And the book concludes with a vision of the final battle for Jerusalem and the coming of the Messiah, and then the Messianic era and the resurrection of the dead, the new heaven and the new earth, new Jerusalem, the world to come, the hope for persecuted believers, le'olam va'ed, forever. That's the story of Revelation in the days of the apostles. Mystics sought out these experiences, these apocalypses, a chance to look behind the veil. They would undertake rigorous fasts, 7-day fasts, 7 days without food and water. Some would undertake 40-day fasts. I don't know how they did it. Ritual purification, you know, absolute ritual purity to
to be able to ascend, to be able to have the opportunity to catch a vision, an angelic vision, fasting and prayer, and they use these as tools to achieve a state of altered consciousness which might allow them to have that glimpse into heavenly realms. Now, Jewish mysticism warns against seeking personal apocalyptic experiences. Not a good idea. It can be very dangerous. And it warns against studying the words of the apocalypses, because they too can be dangerous and easily misunderstood. And in terms of seeking the experience, the Talmud tells us about some who experienced too much, too high, too far, too soon, like Elisha ben Nevuja, who lost his faith because of the things he saw, because the things he saw didn't fit into his box, into his theological box. Or like Shimon ben Zoma, who was just never the same in the head after he experienced an apocalypse. And Paul warns us about those who seek to experience these apocalyptic visions, and he warns us not to fall under their sway. He says, let no one disqualify you, insisting on asceticism and the worship of angels, going on in detail about visions puffed up without reason by his sensuous mind. But on some level, in some ways, we are all trying to achieve apocalypse. A revelation of the spiritual world is what it's all about. That's the name of the game. That's what faith is all about. The mystic, the person of faith, doesn't want to just learn about God and study about God and know about God. The mystic wants to actually be swept up with the unseen and caught up into the divine, whether in the body or out of the body, I don't know. But to know God rather than just to know about God. And the book of Revelation offers us a little bit of that opportunity. And that's the real reason for studying it. It's not going to tell us about events in modern Iraq or Syria or the political aspirations of Putin or conflicts with Iran or ISIS. But it will offer us a glimpse into the unseen world behind the thin veneer that we recognize as reality. And this is the revelation, the apocalypse, the revealing of things concealed, which God gave to his son Yeshua, who entrusted it to his angel, who revealed it to John, who transmitted it to us. So in the words of the book of Revelation, we can ascend like Enoch and like Elijah, along with Paul, along with John, into those heavenly places where the Son of Man is seated at the right hand of glory. And we can experience vicariously the divine amazement of mortal flesh in the midst of the world of the immortal and the spiritual, among myriad angels and the souls of the righteous made perfect. And we can look back from that high vantage point upon the world of men, and thereby better understand our own world and all that befalls us. And in this way, the book of Revelation offers hope even to us today until the end of the age. So, it says in verse 3, how glad is the one who reads and those who hear the words of the prophecy and heed the things which are written in it. For the time is near.
Take on my yoke and learn from me and find rest for your soul.